Hello and welcome to the Talking Information Center. I'm Ron Clark reading the Washington Post on Tuesday, April 7th. First article, Trump threatens to attack bridges, power plants as deadline for Iran deal nears. The president vowed anew to destroy bridges and energy sites if a deal to open the Strait of Hormuz is not reached. President Donald Trump renewed his threat to destroy Iranian bridges and power plants if the country doesn't soon agree to reopen the world oil trade through the Strait of Hormuz, arguing that the Iranian people supported the U.S. and Israeli bombing. The entire country can be taken out in one night, and that night might be tomorrow night, he said Monday, issuing a deadline of Tuesday at 8 p.m. Eastern Time and pledging the destruction by midnight if leaders don't comply. The remarks came during a White House briefing where officials detailed the rescue of two U.S. airmen whose F-15E was shot down over Iran on Friday. CIA Director John Ratcliffe and Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth said Iranian officials were embarrassed by their failure to capture the U.S. aviator who was injured and stranded in rugged, hostile territory for 2 days. Still, the Iranians showed no interest in surrendering, rejecting a U.S.-backed ceasefire proposal on Monday. Trump at once touted the success of U.S. military operations and showed frustration with the elusive resolution to the expensive and unpopular five-week-old war. He has postponed his threat to bomb power plants twice before. We're the winner. We won, okay? The president said in the White House briefing room. They are militarily defeated. The only thing they have is the psychology of, oh, we're going to drop a couple of mines in the water. He brushed off concern that his threat to bomb infrastructure would violate the Geneva Conventions, a series of treaties the U.S. signed after World War II to limit dangers to civilians. We don't want that to happen, Trump said. We may even get involved with helping them rebuild their nation. And you know what? If that's the case, the last thing we want to do is start with power plants, which are among the most expensive things. Trump said U.S. spies had eavesdropped on conversations among Iranian civilians indicating support for the bombing. He started the war by calling on the country's people to rise up and overthrow the government. They would be willing to suffer that in order to have freedom, he said. We've had numerous intercepts. Please keep bombing. Bombs that are dropping near homes. Please keep bombing. Do it. Earlier Monday, Iran refused to back down, saying such attacks would be met with strong response. Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi told his French counterpart in a call that Trump's threat amounts to normalizing war crimes and genocide. Kazem Garabadibadi, a deputy foreign minister, said on X that Trump's threats constitute individual criminal responsibility and that Iran will retaliate with a regret-inducing response. Mohammad Akraminia, an Iranian army spokesman, said Sunday that deterrence for future war relies on bringing the enemy to genuine regret, the Tasnim news agency said. Sunday's rescue operation of a missing U.S. airman averted what could have been a politically catastrophic situation for the White House had Iran taken him as a prisoner of war. But the downing of the F-15E and another U.S. military jet, an A-10 attack plane whose pilot navigated into Kuwait airspace before ejecting, raised questions about Trump's exuberant claims of U.S. air dominance and the destruction of Iran's air defenses. Trump revealed on Monday that the F-15 was likely hit by a shoulder-fired missile known as a MANPAD, or Man-Portable Air Defense System, a relatively cheap weapon that can be fired by a single person on the ground and uses an aircraft's heat signature to track and target it. Despite the country's weakened defenses, shoulder-fired missiles remain a significant threat to U.S. warplanes because of how many Iran has and how easy to hide they are. Trump had previously claimed the U.S. had eliminated Iran's ability to defend from air attacks, saying on March 24th that they can't do a thing about it, and a week later that they have nothing to shoot. We took out a lot, but they still have, he said on Monday, so it's not like, you know, they're totally whatever. A rescue mission was launched almost immediately for the downed crew members. Two HH-60 Pavehawk Air Force Special Operations Command helicopters, an HC-130 Combat King II, A-10 Thunderbolt II attack aircraft and drones began circling and suppressing fighters on the ground until they could rescue the F-15 pilot. In addition to the downed A-10, whose pilot ejected and survived, one of the helicopters involved in the rescue took ground fire, injuring members of the crew. The F-15's weapons system officer, who was wounded, remained missing after the pilot was rescued. Wounded and bleeding, he had landed far from the pilot and began to move up a 7,000-foot ridgeline to hide. For hours, there was no news on where he was. The CIA had eyes on the mountain ridge, and late in the night in Iran, Ratcliffe said he informed Trump, was seeing someone moving on the mountain. For 45 minutes, the agency kept its camera on the form, not sure what it was. Then he stood up, Trump said, and they said, "We have him." More than 150 aircraft soon swarmed different sites to throw off Iranians on the ground as to the location of the airmen. Israel, which assisted in the rescue operation by providing intelligence, announced Monday that it had killed Major General Mahid Kademi, the head of intelligence for Iran's Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps. Kademi's death was confirmed by Iranian news agencies. His predecessor, Mohammad Kazemi, was killed in an Israeli airstrike during the 12-day war in June. Iran's leaders live with the sense of being hunted, Israeli Defense Minister Israel Katz said in the statement. We will continue to hunt them down one by one. Iranian officials continued to reject a 15-point U.S. ceasefire proposal, with Foreign Minister spokesman Esmail Baqai saying at a news conference Monday that Iran finds it excessively demanding, unreasonable, and illogical. On Monday, Baqai said ceasefires often serve to create mere pauses, allowing the United States to regroup and strategize for future attacks, Tasnim reported. Deadlines shouldn't cause us to have the slightest doubt in defending our country, Baqai said. He said the transfer of messages continues naturally between intermediaries, but negotiation is in no way compatible with ultimatums, with crimes, with threats of committing war crimes. Israel also struck a major Iranian petrochemical facility in Asula on Monday after hitting the country's other key plant in Mahashir over the weekend, according to Katz. Together, the facilities are responsible for about 85% of Iran's petrochemical exports, Katz said, and have now been disabled and are no longer operational. Asked in a Monday news briefing how such attacks on dual-use infrastructure squares with negotiations, Nadav Shoshani, an Israeli Defense Forces spokesman, said, "The war is going as talks are going. Iran will pay a price as the time goes by," Shoshani said. Iran has previously a strategy of stalling and using negotiations to create time, an accusation Iranian officials leveled against the United States the same day. Antonio Costa, president of the European Council, said attacks on civilian infrastructure, emphasizing energy facilities, is illegal and unacceptable. He said he stressed this in the call with Iranian President Masoud Pezeshkian. "The Iranian civilian population is the main victim of the Iranian regime. It would also be the main victim of a widening military campaign," Costa wrote on X. Strikes continued across the region. More than 2,000 people have been killed in Iran during the war, according to the International Federation of the Red Cross. Lebanon's health ministry said at least 1,497 people have been killed in the attacks, including an attack overnight on a team of paramedics that killed two. The ministry condemned systematic Israeli attacks on the country's health sector. More than 50 people have been killed in attacks affecting healthcare groups in Lebanon, according to UN and World Health Organization representatives in the country. In Israel, an Iranian missile directly hit, but reportedly did not detonate, a seven-story building in the northern port of Haifa. After searching through rubble overnight, search and rescue teams recovered the bodies of four people killed and trapped under the rubble. End of article. Next article, Trump says God supports U.S. cause in Iran war as he threatens wider bombing. The president offered a new rationale for the costly, unpopular conflict. God wants to see people taken care of, he said. As President Donald Trump renews his threat to bomb the entire country of Iran, he is offering a new justification for the costly 5-week conflict with no clear end in sight. God himself wants the United States to do it. Trump said Monday that he believed God supports the United States' actions in the U.S.-Israeli war in Iran, a widening conflict that has killed thousands in the Middle East, wounded many more, and left 13 U.S. service members dead. "I do, because God is good," Trump said in response to a Washington Post reporter's question during a White House news briefing, "and God wants to see people taken care of." Trump's comments mark a shift in how he is describing the war. After offering conflicting explanations for U.S. involvement, including whether his goal is regime change, he's begun in recent days to cast the conflict in religious terms as he raises the possibility of broader strikes. The president earlier Monday threatened to bomb the country's power and transportation infrastructure until it resembles the Stone Ages. He claimed that such actions are welcomed by Iranian people who want their government overthrown and who, he said, are begging the U.S. to please keep bombing. Trump did not answer a question about whether he has sought God's direction as the conflict escalated, but he suggested that the Almighty supports U.S. action, even if God is grieved by the violence. "God doesn't like what's happening. I don't like what's happening," Trump continued. "Everyone says I enjoy it. I don't enjoy this. I don't enjoy it." He went on to tout that he had ended 8 wars earlier in his term, a reference he has frequently made to brokering peace deals between India and Pakistan, Armenia and Azerbaijan, and others. "That makes me much happier than what we're doing right now," he said. Trump, who identifies as a Christian but does not claim to regularly pray or read the Bible, has invoked faith at times in his second term, including suggesting that his political return and survival after an assassination attempt carried a larger purpose. The language has echoed that some of his supporters who have cast him as a figure protected or chosen by God. In recent days, Trump has hinted that the war is an existential battle between Christianity and Islam. "Open the fucking straight, you crazy bastards, or you'll be living in hell. Just watch. Praise be to Allah," Trump wrote in social media post Easter Sunday morning. U.S. presidents have often invoked faith in times of conflict, but others, such as George W. Bush and Barack Obama, who also presided over war in the Middle East, have gone out of their way to emphasize that the United States was not battling Muslims or Islam, but a specific group of people who had attacked America. Some Muslim leaders quickly condemned Trump's use of the "praise be" phrase as a mockery of the religion, including the Imams Council of Michigan, a state where Trump made gains with Muslim voters in 2024. Imam Steve El Turk called Trump's post a dangerous escalation that undermines both international stability and the moral fabric of public discourse. The post on Sunday drew parallels to one the president had made a day earlier. "Time is running out, 48 hours before all hell will rain down on them. Glory be to God," Trump wrote on Truth Social on Saturday. Some Catholic leaders have harshly criticized U.S. strikes in Iran, including Pope Leo, who on Palm Sunday preached that God does not listen to the prayers of those who wage war. 2 days later, Leo urged Trump by name to end the war. Leo, the first American-born pope, had previously criticized the Trump administration's policies more broadly without mentioning the president himself. And Trump ally-turned-critic Marjorie Taylor Greene, a Republican former congresswoman and a Protestant Christian, on Sunday bashed the president's vows to escalate the war, declaring that Trump is not a Christian. "Jesus commanded us to love one another and forgive one another, even our enemies," Greene wrote. Monday, in describing the rescue of a U.S. airman in mountainous region of Iran, Trump credited God for looking out for the U.S. mission, which he previously described as miraculous. "Well, it was the Easter. We were in Easter territory, I guess," Trump said. "But God was watching. Amazing." Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth, who flanked Trump throughout the briefing, used the metaphor of the crucifixion, death, burial in a tomb, and resurrection of Jesus to discuss the military's rescue of the colonel on Sunday. "You see, shot down on the Friday, Good Friday, hidden in a cave, in a crevice, all of Saturday, and rescued on Sunday," Hegseth said. "Flown out of Iran as the sun was rising on Easter Sunday, a pilot reborn." End of article. Next article, Virginians deeply divided on Spanberger after her landslide win. A Washington Post Char poll finds that Virginia voters are highly polarized over Governor Abigail Spanberger, who ran as a unifying centrist. Virginia Governor Abigail Spanberger's approval rating stands at 47% 2 months into the Democrats' term, with 46% of voters disapproving and 7% expressing no opinion in a Washington Post Char School poll. Spanberger won in a 15-point landslide last year after touting her reputation for bipartisanship built on 3 terms representing a conservative-leaning district in Congress. But her current ratings reflect sharp polarization among Virginia voters in their views of the state's first female governor. The approval mark for Spanberger is 13 percentage points lower than the average for Virginia governors in post-polling since the 1990s. Her near-even split between approval and disapproval is a worse net approval rating than the early-term scores of her predecessors in previous post-polls. It is also slightly weaker than ratings of her immediate predecessor, Glenn Youngkin, in a post-Char school poll last fall, showing he ended his term with 50% approval and 46% disapproval. Unlike Spanberger, Youngkin had come into office with a very narrow victory. When asked, Virginians are more divided over Spanberger than previous governors. In a positive sign for Spanberger, elements of her affordability agenda score well with voters, suggesting room to improve her image after a rocky start. The governor also continues to be more popular than President Donald Trump among Virginia voters, 40% of whom approve of his performance while 57% disapprove. A larger share of voters express strong disapproval of Spanberger's performance than of her predecessors. 2/3 say they either strongly approve, 29%, or strongly disapprove, 38%. Fewer than 6 in 10 felt strongly about Youngkin's performance at any point in her tenure, with 28% strongly approving and 25% strongly disapproving in the post-Char polling last September. Some amount of polarization is baked in, but this is unusual at this early stage of her administration and given that she had long cultivated a centrist image, said Mark Rozelle, dean of George Mason University's Char School of Policy and Government, which co-sponsored the poll. While she has maintained the support of her Democratic base, more than 8 in 10 Democrats approve of her performance, Spanberger has not made inroads with Republicans, nearly 9 in 10 of whom disapprove. In addition, Spanberger gets more strong disapproval from Republicans, 78%, than strong approval from Democrats, 62%. Independent voters are split with 45% approving and 46% disapproving of Spanberger. Last fall, she won 59% of independent votes, including, according to network exit polling. Spanberger has largely kept promises to pursue pocketbook-minded legislation such as improving access to health care and investing in affordable housing, and has worked with Democratic leaders in the General Assembly to quash talk of tax increases. But Rozelle noted that her moderate image has been complicated by several factors that provided fodder for intensely negative campaigns from the right. She condemned Trump's immigration operations and ended controversial partnership agreements between state law enforcement and federal immigration authorities. She has grudgingly supported efforts to redraw the state's congressional districts to heavily favor Democrats, again resisting Trump, who has pushed Republican states to redraw districts to preserve the GOP majority in the U.S. House. The Trump administration has routinely excoriated Spanberger in public statements and news releases, and the post-Char school poll found strong partisan sentiment about redistricting. In addition, multiple tax proposals in the General Assembly, even though not enacted and not championed by Spanberger, drove a narrative of Democrats in Richmond lurching way left, which likely affected perceptions of the governor, Rozelle said. Gregory Roddy, a self-described independent voter from Fairfax County who leans conservative, said he was always skeptical of Spanberger's pitch as a bipartisan candidate. Once she was elected, Spanberger switched over, he said, citing her swift move to curtail Virginia's cooperation with federal immigration authorities. Now she's just a bot for the Democratic Party, Roddy, 69, said. But Spanberger's quick actions on issues such as immigration enforcement won her praise from voters like Marcus Shaw, who describes himself as left of center but wary of Democrats. Shaw distrusted Spanberger when he voted for her, but said her boldness could prove useful for Virginians in the long run. I really appreciate somebody that takes up the mantle, goes in, and says, okay, we're doing XYZ, said Shaw, 30, of Hampton. The poll finds 45% of Virginia voters think Spanberger's views are too liberal, while 42% think they're just about right, and 7% say she's too conservative. Virginians roughly split between saying Spanberger's too liberal or just about right. The scope of her image problem is apparent in the disconnect between voter impressions of her actions and her specific affordability policies. Spanberger has cautioned that there is no automatic strategy to improve cost of living, but more voters think Spanberger's policies will make Virginia less affordable, 41%, than more affordable, 31%, while 23% don't think her policies will make a difference. Even among Democrats, 63% think Spanberger's policies will improve affordability, but more than 3 in 10 think they won't make a difference or will make the state less affordable. About 8 in 10 Republicans predict her policies will make the state less affordable. Independents are skew negative on Spanberger's actions, with 41% saying they will make the state less affordable versus 27% who say they will make the state more affordable. Mason Netschy, a self-described independent voter in rural Culpeper County, said he did not vote for Spanberger, but hoped she would improve the cost of living. Instead, he feels she's been trying to make herself into a Democratic icon. I don't see anything that makes me think I'll be able to own a home again one day in this state, said Netschy, a 44-year-old car parts salesman. Spanberger has requested and signed a host of legislation aimed at housing affordability, lowering energy bills, and boosting resources for low-income households. Asked about specific Spanberger policies, Virginians are more optimistic, believing that 6 of the 8 priorities mentioned in the poll will make living in the state more affordable. Those include reducing regulations on small solar panel systems, encouraging mixed-income housing development, and requiring electric companies to help lower-income residents improve their home energy efficiency. Affordability is a great campaign theme, but almost an impossible governing one, given the limited tools that a governor has to affect prices, Roselle said. The public may like the particulars of some of her proposals, but as long as the overall environment on affordability remains unchanged, there is inevitable disappointment. Voters' perspectives change based on income level, however, with Spanberger's approval rating slightly higher among families making under $100,000. Her support from black Virginia voters appear shaky, with 2/3 saying they approve of Spanberger's performance, compared with the 93% of black voters who supported her last fall, according to network exit polls. Spanberger maintains an edge with women voters, 52% of whom approve of her performance, while 54% of men disapprove. The poll was conducted by The Post and George Mason University's Schar School of Policy and Government from March 26 to the 31st among a random sample of 1,100 registered voters in Virginia drawn from a statewide voter database. Live caller interviews reach respondents on cell phones and landlines. 22% of respondents were reached via text message and invited to take the survey online. The overall margin of error is plus or minus 3.4 percentage points. End of article. Next article, Trump administration's secrecy on health deals alarms experts and governments. A dearth of information has been disclosed about the agreements, fueling speculation that the America First approach to foreign aid is exploitative. The Trump administration has spent the better part of a year quietly negotiating agreements with poorer nations as it seeks to scale back and reimagine U.S. foreign assistance for efforts like HIV and tuberculosis prevention through a new America First global health strategy. To date, 28 deals have been negotiated with foreign governments, mostly throughout Africa. But in a break with precedent, the administration has refused to disclose their full terms publicly. The veil of secrecy has frustrated partner countries and angered transparency advocates who worry that billions of dollars in U.S. funding, money that's intended to help combat disease, is being leveraged by the Trump administration as it seeks controversial concessions on unrelated policies in return. Public Citizen, a government watchdog group, has brought a lawsuit demanding access to some of the administration's global health agreements, arguing that the State Department's failure to produce the records in response to a Freedom of Information Act request is unlawful. The agreement's public disclosure is essential to understanding the new foreign aid structure being built by the State Department and what the United States expects or extracts in return, said Peter Mabardick, director of Public Citizens Access to Medicines Group. The State Department, which has led the overhaul of a health-related foreign aid since last year's dismantling of the U.S. Agency for International Development, said it does not comment on ongoing litigation, but that it takes its transparency obligations very seriously. In a statement, the agency vowed to disclose the terms of its agreements once negotiations with all partner governments are complete, saying its approach is consistent with the applicable law and intended to protect sensitive conversations. The State Department did not address questions about how many negotiations may be ongoing and when those talks might conclude, but said it was fully on track with a plan developed last year. In some foreign capitals, frustration has been building for months, according to diplomats and U.S. officials who spoke in the condition of anonymity to discuss the process. In Zimbabwe, for instance, President Emmerson Mnangagwa halted his country's negotiations with the Trump administration late last year after the government determined that the lopsided talks risked undermining Zimbabwe's sovereignty, according to correspondence reviewed by The Washington Post. The U.S. Embassy in Harare confirmed in February that Zimbabwe had withdrawn from the negotiations and that the United States would begin winding down our health assistance to Zimbabwe. In neighboring Zambia, where a deal was expected to be signed in December, talks have become a political pressure point for the government amid reports that the Trump administration is seeking to leverage the aid money as it seeks concessions on a separate agreement related to the mining of critical minerals. The Trump administration is pushing for greater access to critical minerals in Africa, such as copper in Zambia, to challenge Chinese dominance of a resource that is vital for building modern technology like electric vehicles and data centers. The State Department has rejected those accusations, though officials have acknowledged the administration is taking a new approach to global health. I can say unequivocally, we are not seeking anything at Zambia's expense or against Zambia's laws or interests, Nick Checker, a senior State Department official for Africa, said at a summit in Washington last month. But how we negotiate this and what we expect from them will be fundamentally different from approaches of the past that failed to deliver for either Zambia's sustainable future or for the American people. Global health agreements are part of a new strategy that is designed, officials say, to reduce overall U.S. spending on such initiatives and push partner countries to spend more themselves to break a cycle of dependency. Under the Trump administration, agreements worth $12.7 billion in U.S. assistance have been signed so far, requiring recipient countries to invest $7.8 billion, according to the State Department. Our foreign assistance programs are deeply broken, Secretary of State Marco Rubio wrote in an introduction to the administration's America First global health policy last year. Our health foreign assistance programs in particular have become inefficient and wasteful. Even among critics of the administration, there is widespread agreement about the problems of waste and dependency in global health assistance. But numerous experts say the negotiations, which have been led by Trump political appointees with little background in complex global health deals, have been conducted largely behind closed doors with no outside input and little congressional oversight. Public Citizens Mabardick said that the strategy seems to be divide and conquer the partners of the United States. The Trump administration, he said, is treating its negotiating partners as hostiles and treating health aid a bit like conflict, as though every bit of U.S. negotiating advantage must be preserved through secrecy. There have been five signed agreements publicly released by the U.S. government thus far, though it appears that was done accidentally. The documents outlining deals with Kenya, Uganda, Mozambique, Nigeria, and Ethiopia were published on an obscure government website in March, but a few days later, the zip file that contained copies of the agreement's text was deleted. It was later republished without those documents. Excuse me. The State Department, in its response to questions, said that the five agreements released on its website were posted in error. We took them down to treat all partner countries consistently and will repost them, along with the rest, once the full set of agreements is finalized. That is a process fix, not a cover-up, the agency said. Curtis Bradley, a professor of the University of Chicago Law School, who has studied laws on public disclosure of such agreements, said there appeared to be no legal requirements to publish all the agreements at once. There is nothing in the statute about this, he said. A handful of other agreements have circulated after being leaked. The Kenyan government publicly released the terms of its agreements with Washington after a legal challenge there said the provisions, the deal granted the U.S. wide access to Kenyan citizens' health data and biological specimens, were unconstitutional. The five agreements temporarily posted to the State Department's website offer a glimpse into how the deals may differ from one country to the next. The documents show that overall U.S. funding will decline significantly in each country over a five-year period, but the rate at which it declines and the amount by which each country is expected to boost its own health spending varies significantly. Some countries, such as Nigeria, are being asked to rapidly increase their share of health spending, the documents show. Others, such as Mozambique, have less ambiguous spending pledges, but the documents show they could face an abrupt U.S. funding cutoff if those lower targets are not met. The State Department said the circumstances are different for each country and that the deals reflect how both sides are putting skin in the game to ensure lasting impact. Some countries that signed health agreements with the United States were in unrelated, contentious negotiations with Washington around the same time. Rwanda and the Democratic Republic of Congo, for example, had recently signed U.S.-brokered peace deals when they agreed to the health pacts, leading to concerns that traditionally apolitical health funding was being used as a political pressure tool. At least nine countries, including several with major HIV epidemics like Eswatini, have concurrently held negotiations with the Trump administration to receive third country nationals deported from the United States. Critics of the administration's approach say the blurring of lines between U.S. global health policy and other aims risks undermining efforts to fight diseases like HIV, and that the lack of information released publicly added to the perception the deals were being used as a pressure tool. Until the Trump administration, said Mebardak, health was not something to hide. End of article. Next article. More states adopt college entrance exam touted by conservatives despite concerns. Military academies and colleges in North Carolina and Indiana will soon accept the classic learning test, embraced by the Trump administration and mainly featuring Western texts. An upstart college entrance exam, designed to be an alternative to the ACT and SAT and featuring works from ancient Western civilization, is gaining support from the Trump administration and conservatives in red and purple states. In recent months, the Pentagon decided to accept the classic learning test for U.S. military service academies and scholarships at other colleges around the country. Indiana exacted legislation in March requiring its state's universities to consider CLT scores along with those from SAT and ACT. And the North Carolina University system agreed to take the CLT, including its flagship campus in Chapel Hill. We've had some big wins, said Jeremy Tate, of the test founder, and the Maryland company behind it, Classic Learning Initiatives. While all three tests have verbal and math sections, the CLT stands out because it mainly features passages from noted philosophers, religious scholars, scientists, and others in the canon of Western literature, including Plato, St. Augustine, Dante, and Shakespeare. Students take the test at a traditional testing site or online at home. Since its creation in 2015, the CLT has been embraced by many Christian schools, homeschooling families, and educators in the classical education movement who want children to study foundational texts that they say help shape American history and culture. But the exam's growing popularity has sparked questions about whether the CLT is a reliable measure of student skills, how to compare CLT scores to ACT and SAT, and whether it's secure since students can take the CLT at home, unlike the other two tests. We're lacking evidence on the CLT. Audrey Amrain Bedslev, a professor at Arizona State University who's reviewing public data on the test and plans to publish findings this summer. And as the test becomes more widely used, the CLT's creators hope it will push schools and teachers to introduce students to classic tests to better prepare them for the exam. We view this as a lever that shapes education, Tate said. But some critics worry the CLT's list of authors could push out alternate points of view and give students a sanitized and triumphalist version of history. My biggest concern is that students won't learn the truth about history, said Curtis Dozier, a Vassar College professor of Greek and Roman Studies, who wrote a book about how far-right politicians use the classics to advance their worldview. More than 350 universities, mostly private Christian colleges, accept CLT scores for admissions, in addition to the ACT and SAT. Many other colleges have been hesitant. A review by the Iowa Board of Regents in 2024 couldn't find a single peer-reviewed study on how well the CLT can predict success in college. There's just been limited use thus far of the classic learning test, so there isn't sufficient data yet, Rachel Boone, chief academic officer for the board, said at a public meeting at the time. The state is now searching for additional data, she said in an interview. Because of the lack of research, the Iowa State University system decided in 2024 to use only the ACT or SAT for automatic admissions, the route most students use to attend. Classic Learning said the test value was detailed in a study completed last year at Grove City College, a conservative Christian college in Pennsylvania. The study of 235 students, which has yet to be published in an academic journal, found CLT test scores are strongly correlated with first-year college grades. But the study's author says he doesn't have enough data yet to say whether it's better or worse than SAT and ACT. My conclusion at this point is that they're all three reasonable predictors for college grades, said Gary Welton, assistant dean for institutional assessment at the college. There's also the question of what can be considered a good CLT score, since the test is newer than ACT or the SAT. Classic Learning developed a table in 2023 to help interpret the numbers. For example, it says a score of 100 on the CLT out of a perfect 120 is equivalent to a 1390 out of 1600 on the SAT and a 31 out of 36 on the ACT. The company wasn't able to reach an agreement, though, to work with ACT and College Board to pool their data for comparison. We're not sure these tests are similar enough to compare the scores, said Priscilla Rodriguez, a senior vice president with the College Board, which administers the SAT. Meanwhile, the CLT has gained strong support from conservatives who complain the SAT and ACT have dumbed down their tests over the years. For instance, the SAT and ACT started allowing calculators in the mid-1990s. The SAT also eliminated its antonym section, designed to test students on vocabulary, and replaced longer reading passages with shorter text, some just a few sentences long. It is generally bland material that doesn't have any inherent value in it, said Jonathan Butcher of the Heritage Foundation, a conservative think tank. The classic learning test is asking students to be prepared to handle more rigorous content. The CLT does not allow students to use calculators, and the CLT boasts that two-thirds of its reading passages come from an author bank of more than 160 writers and works, dating back to Mesopotamia. More than two dozen of the authors are Christian saints, theologians, or religious thinkers, including the Puritan preacher Jonathan Edwards, best known for his sermon, Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God. Though the test is popular with many Christian private schools, it is not exclusively Christian or religious. And Tate, the test's founder, notes there is good reason to introduce all kinds of students to important Christian texts. I don't think anyone in the West can be considered seriously educated without some knowledge of the Christian intellectual tradition, including the Bible, he said. While the SAT and ACT use some older literature as well, The SAT once featured a passage from Aristophanes in 423 BC. They generally put more emphasis on contemporary writing than the CLT. The ACT notes that it still features longer passages, while the College Board says it switched to shorter excerpts on the SAT to encourage students to read the passages closely instead of scanning them for answers. Partly because the CLT allows students to take the test at home, it has grown especially popular in the homeschooling community. Parker Falk, a 16-year-old homeschooler in Michigan, said he had to travel as far as an hour and a half to take the ACT, but was able to take the CLT in a bedroom. It was nicer to be able to take the test in my own environment, Falk said. The ACT and College Board said they don't offer remote testing because of the increased risk of cheating or the questions getting leaked. Trust is of the utmost importance, said ACT spokesman Juan Elizondo. Classic Learning executives said that they've taken strong measures to deter misconduct, including requiring students to keep web cameras on and install software that prevents them from opening other windows on their computer screens. We have really, really high standard for tech security, Tate said. The CLT faces an uphill challenge to become as popular as the SAT and ACT, but it is making gains. Nearly 183,000 students took the test last year, compared to just 291 a decade ago. By comparison, more than 2 million graduating seniors in the class of 2025 took the SAT at least once in high school, and 1.4 million took the ACT. While most colleges do not require test scores, some elite schools do, and it's widely thought that a high score can aid students' applications at others. More public colleges are also starting to accept the CLT, in part because of support from Republicans and state legislatures. Indiana State Senator Gary Byrne, who wrote the bill requiring a public university there that take the ACT and SAT also to accept the CLT, said he wanted to give students and parents another choice. He said he also hopes the measure will encourage more public schools to introduce students to classic works. It's just going back to what we used to do, Byrne said. Lawmakers in Arkansas passed a similar bill last year, and another bill is moving forward in Ohio. And in 2023, Florida decided to accept the CLT as an additional option for university admissions, scholarships, and to meet certain high school graduation requirements. Some other states, including Louisiana, Oklahoma, and Wyoming, also now accept the CLT for state scholarships. Despite the push from conservatives, Tate denied that the test is partisan or limited to one worldview. The author pool for reading the section of the CLT includes both Adam Smith, the father of capitalism, and Karl Marx, a father of communism. It contains Christian preachers, but also the Chinese philosopher Confucius, Muslim scholar Avicenna and Friedrich Nietzsche, the German writer who famously declared that God is dead. And while most of the authors are white, the pool also has black civil rights leaders like Sojourner Truth, Frederick Douglass, and Martin Luther King, Jr. One-third of the passages come from sources outside the CLT's public author list, including many modern thinkers. A recent exam included an essay from liberal jurist Ruth Bader Ginsburg. Regardless, the CLT faces other hurdles to catch up to the SAT and ACT. Some states offer either the SAT or ACT to nearly all public high school students to measure their performance. Students often stick with those when applying for scholarships or college. And most of the elite schools that require entrance exams only accept the SAT and ACT. Tate believes that is starting to change, with the military academies and University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill starting to accept the CLT this year. And Tate said he recently had a private meeting with an Ivy League school. In the foyer of the Classic Learning Initiative's headquarters, Tate showed a Washington Post reporter a historic marker that exemplifies the company's ambition. The faded bronze sign notes the Classic Learning Test was founded in 2015, then takes a futuristic turn. In 2040, the CLT surpassed the SAT and ACT as the number one college entering exam globally. Tate expects that prediction to eventually become reality. We're tracking a little bit ahead of what we need to get to the 2040 goal, both in terms of test takers and good national awareness, Tate said. By then, Tate might also know if he's accomplished his broader goal, changing what children learn in the classroom. End of article. Next article. Artemis II's crew has now flown farther than any humans. The crew of NASA's Artemis II mission has officially ventured farther into space than any humans before, zooming more than 248,655 miles from Earth in its historic voyage around the far side of the moon. The distance record, set just before 2 p.m. Eastern on Monday, surpasses a milestone set by the Apollo 13 crew in 1970. During that mission, an oxygen tank explosion prompted the astronauts to ditch their landing plans and slingshot themselves around the moon before arriving safely home. On April 15th, three explorers set the record for the farthest distance humans have ever traveled from our home planet. Kelsey Young, a science officer for Artemis II, told the crew from Mission Control, "Today, for all humanity, you're pushing beyond that frontier." The spacecraft will be closest to the moon and farthest from home about 7 p.m. today, when Artemis II will set yet another record for human travelers, 252,760 miles from Earth. Artemis II Commander Reid Wiseman, pilot Victor Glover, and mission specialists Christina Koch and Jeremy Hansen awoke Monday morning to a special message recorded by Apollo 13 Commander Jim Lovell before his death last year. "Welcome to my old neighborhood," Lovell said. "It's a historic day, and I know how busy you'll be, but don't forget to enjoy the view." Monday's milestone marks the start of Artemis II's crucial lunar observation period, when the crew will document a celestial landscape that no human has seen before. The Apollo missions were orchestrated so astronauts would arrive at the moon when its near side was facing the sun, giving them plenty of light for landings. But Artemis II's lunar flyby will occur when the far side is illuminated, giving the crew a glimpse of craters, mountains, and other features that were too dark or difficult to see during the Apollo era. NASA lunar scientist Sarah Noble said the moon's ancient landscape, untouched by organisms, rainfall, plate tectonics, and other forces that constantly reshape rocks on Earth, makes it an ideal place to study the processes that shape the early solar system. "On the moon, we have an entire record that goes back 4.5 billion years," she said. "If we really want to learn about what was happening in that period, the moon is the only place we can go." "It is blowing my mind what you can see with the naked eye on the moon right now," Wiseman told Mission Control on Monday. "It is just unbelievable." The astronauts have already begun identifying new lunar features. Shortly after breaking the Apollo 13 distance record, Hansen requested that a previously unknown crater be dubbed Integrity, after the crew's name for its Orion capsule. "A bright spot on the border between the moon's near side and far side," Hansen said, "should be named Carol, after Wiseman's spouse, who died of cancer in 2020. About 6:45 p.m., the crew will watch Earth set, when our home planet will slide beneath the moon's horizon, cutting off communications with Mission Control. About 40 minutes later, the astronauts will witness Earthrise, seeing a view similar to what Lovell and his crewmates witnessed during the Apollo 8 mission in 1968. Speaking to Mission Control on Monday, Koch said that she had that photograph hanging in her room as a child. The bleak gray lunar landscape in the foreground, the black void of space as a backdrop, and at its center, Earth's blue and white emerging from shadow, gleaming like a beacon in the endless night. End of article. Next article, Trump threatens to jail reporters if they don't turn over Iran source. "Give it up or go to jail," the president said at the Monday press briefing, referring to the identity of a source who disclosed details to an unidentified news organization about the U.S. airman previously missing in Iran. President Donald Trump threatened to force a news organization to turn over the name of an anonymous source who revealed details about a U.S. airman who went missing in Iran, several outlets reported on the lost airman, who was subsequently rescued after his fighter jet was shot down. "We're looking very hard to find that leaker," Trump said in a press briefing. "They didn't know there was somebody missing until this leaker gave them the information. So whoever it was, we think we'll be able to find out, because we're going to go to the media company that released it, and we're going to say, national security, give it up or go to jail." Trump, who frequently spars with media companies and individual reporters by name, did not say which outlet he was referring to. The Justice Department did not respond immediately to questions about what organization and reporters Trump was referring to. In its response to similar questions, the White House said an investigation is underway. Trump claimed that Iran learned that the crew member was missing in its territory only from media reports, and this attention complicated the search and rescue mission. "All of a sudden, they know that there's somebody out there," Trump said. "They see all these planes coming in. It became a much more difficult operation because a leaker leaked that we have one. We've rescued one. But there's another one out there that we're trying to get." He called the source a sick person, though he said they probably didn't realize the extent of how bad it was. Still, he said, "The person that did the story will go to jail if he doesn't say, and that doesn't last long." The Justice Department in 2025 rescinded a Biden-era policy that safeguarded journalists from subpoenas during leak investigations. The Washington Post has faced off with federal prosecutors in recent months after a Post reporter's home was searched and her devices seized in January as part of an investigation of a government contractor accused of illegally retaining classified government materials. A federal magistrate judge in March blocked the government from searching the reporter's electronic devices. Jameel Jaffer, executive director at the Knight First Amendment Institute at Columbia University, said in a statement that news organizations have a First Amendment right to publish stories on matters of public importance, including those the government would rather suppress. President Trump's threat to force journalists to disclose their sources raises serious press freedom concerns because journalists' ability to do their work turns in part on their ability to protect their sources and identities. Jaffer said, "President Trump's threat should be understood as an effort to intimidate the press and to prevent journalists from doing work the public needs them to do." Clayton Wiemers, executive director of Reporters Without Borders North America, said that this isn't the first threat of its kind from Trump and likely won't be the last. "This is not just Trumpian bluster," he said. "We should take him both seriously and literally. This is the same Trump administration that misled a judge in order to seize the work and personal devices of Washington Post reporter Hannah Nathanson. It's the same administration that arrested and charged Don Lemon and Georgia Fort for reporting in Minnesota. This administration thinks journalism is a crime." End of article. Next article, from Oman, a waterfront view of the embattled Strait of Hormuz. Residents of Kasab, a sleepy exclave that depends on fishing and tourism, are frustrated by the war and fearful of what's next. At the border crossing into Oman from the United Arab Emirates, jagged limestone cliffs give way to turquoise waters stretching into the distance. The shores of Iran are 45 minutes away by speedboat, the Strait of Hormuz even closer. A small boat churning up a white wake was the only sign of activity on a recent morning, cutting across otherwise eerily quiet water. The boat, locals explained, was likely carrying goats and fresh produce to Omani shores from Iran. This area has captured the world's attention for more than a month, with the strait, a vital passageway for the world's oil supply, now emblematic of the steep cost of the U.S.-Israeli war as Iran's retaliatory strikes leave the waterway all but impassable. The approaching boat, one of many that locals said ferry daily between the two nations, was an example of how local trade continues in this deeply interconnected region and how quiet fishing towns like Kasab now find themselves on the front lines of the war. "We're like cousins," Shaima Ahmad, 32, said of Iranians and Omanis. "Now everyone is afraid and afraid to speak. We don't want to create problems, and we know Kasab is in the middle." The sleepy town, with a population of about 21,000, is built on fishing and tourism. Known in part for its isolation, Kasab is an exclave, separated from the rest of Oman and surrounded on land by the United Arab Emirates. When trade was cut by half during the coronavirus pandemic, Ahmad said Iran was the first nation to send much-needed food. Ties between Kassab and Iran, which are about 24 miles apart, abound, she said, with Iranians setting up businesses in Kassab and Iranian women often marrying the town's fishermen. Now, Kassab's residents listen most days to distant booms as United States and Israel pummel Iran with bombs. Most people here are frustrated with the U.S. for launching the war, Ahmad said, and fearful of what's next. We never imagined this would happen, said Ali Mohammed Suleiman, 40, a boat captain who said his best catches, including tuna, squid, and barracuda, all used to come from the Strait of Hormuz and the waters closest to Iran. Before, we could go anywhere. Since the war started, Suleiman said the strait has been off limits to fishermen who are fined by Omani military when they get too close. He is from the village of Kamzar, located directly on the Strait of Hormuz and accessible only by helicopter or an hour boat ride. Kumzar is so connected with Iran that many of the words in its language, Kumzari, are Persian. We don't know what will happen, Suleiman said, adding that he fears a ground invasion and we can only hope for peace. President Donald Trump has signaled that he is preparing to wind down the war, but also indicated that it could escalate first. In social media posts on Sunday, he celebrated the rescue of the crew of a downed F-15E fighter jet and warned that of fierce bombing on Tuesday of Iran's power plants and bridges. Previously, he threatened to bomb the country back to the Stone Ages. The Strait of Hormuz remains a flashpoint, with Tehran insisting on full control over it as one demand for ending the war. Trump on Sunday reiterated his demand that Iranians reopen the waterway in a profanity-laden social media post. Excuse me. A UK-led coalition of more than 40 countries met on Thursday to discuss efforts to secure safe passage for vessels, but how they will gain control of the waterway remains unclear. The narrow geography and proximity to Iran would make such a mission complicated and dangerous. Oman, which mediated the last round of nuclear talks between the United States and Iran before the U.S. and Israel attacked, has tried to remain neutral. Even after Iran bombed Oman's main port, Oman's foreign minister described Iranian retaliation as an inevitable result of the U.S.-Israeli aggression. End of article. Thank you for joining us at the Talking Information Center, and please enjoy a wonderful day.